interview with the professor of geology at the University of Louisville, and that's how you can get a hold of me. So if you do tweet, I'll tweet back with you. And I'll talk about the grains of island universes. You can try to come up with a nice poetic term. Immanuel Kant came up with island universes for galaxies, and I studied the dust grains in them. So I studied the grains on the beaches of island universes. That's how I think of it. If you want to make a galaxy, you need the following things. So, for instance, the Milky Way is made out of gas, stars, dark matter, and a little bit of dust. And if you can't make out the fraction of dust that goes in it, I don't blame you. It's mostly dark matter. So a little bit of stars, a little bit of gas, and a sliver of dust you can't even see. That little material. There's just not a lot of it. but at the very end, it's less than 1% of all the material. But why is it so interesting? Because this stuff changes the way we perceive galaxies. It changes. It's pretty important because we are standing, in fact, on one of the larger dust motes in the galaxy. It's very important for planets. So you make planets out of lots of dust. And so this is one of my, when I was doing my undergrad, I love this picture because it shows all the different ways you can look at our own galaxy. So this is gas, it's in the thin band. In the infrared, we see that the stars mostly follow that around as well. The infrared, in the optical, we see the dark band, and that's the dust. So that's the bit that I'm interested in. You notice that it doesn't show anywhere else. It just messes up our view of the stars in the optical. We're optical people, we're monkeys who see things by light, and so us astronomers are quite bothered by the dark clouds here. We can't see the stars and we want to get them. So why are we interested in us? It's a key ingredient. Stars, especially planets, are the ones we're studying on. and it radically changes how we see a galaxy. This is what astronomers really mean when we say dust. Dust kind of evokes the whole, well, you should sweep up. You know, you get that whole, well, you guys should clean up and kind of attitude. But no, what we're talking about really is smog. It is the kind of like the fumes that are left over after a star blows up, or it's complex organic molecules. It's a whole series of things. But really, the closest analogy is coming out of your tailpipe. Especially if you didn't change the oil. So I made a variation of this talk in South Africa, and there was a particularly farty car there that was called the Toyota Taz. And basically, whenever you saw one of those, you could smell it, and there was a big plume. So I said, well, you know, we're basically studying whatever the Toyota Taz has left out in the galaxy. So what does it do? So if dust in our atmosphere, if you have a volcano or you have lots of smog, you get very beautiful sunsets. You get these red, glowy sunsets because the dust in our atmosphere filters out the blue light and it reddens the starlight. So whenever we're looking at a star, be it at sunset or in the Milky Way, if it has dust in front of it, it's become redder, and so less blue, it's going to become dimmer and redder. And so that's the effect of dust that we're looking for. One of my other favorite, I worked at the Hubble Institute for a while, so I have all these Hubble pictures that are all my favorite. So here's 363 Monoceros, which has basically ejected the shell of stuff. And so that's where dust comes from. This is the, what was
shell from a supernova?
It's, I think that was another supernova, or was basically an ejection, a mass ejection of the heavier stars. I don't do that. I'm not interested in single stars. I'm a galaxy person, so if it doesn't come in 10 million stars or less, then I'm like, the way ants count, right? It's either a billion or zero. And so that's how extra galactic people work as well. But it lovely shows how you get that plumes of things, and it's illuminated by all the stars in the middle here. So dust affects everything, and this is my favorite thing to show here because, like, it's astrochemistry. It works as a catalyst. And, you know, if you want to have reactions at, you know, near zero temperature, you have to have a catalyst. And so it works as a catalyst to make all kinds of things. It's incredibly important in planet formation. You need this stuff in order to have to cool down and actually become planets. Star formation and planet formation are actually quite related. It affects distance indicator. It affects just about every light that we get from galaxies. It both shields and makes molecular gas. There's all kinds of things that are happening. The trouble is, if I start running through all of them, I get this kind of talk where everybody goes like, yeah, there's a lot going on, and it's not very useful. So I'm going to one distance indicator and light from galaxies. That's what I'm going to talk about. But there's a ton of other stuff. That's the reason that we're interested in material. The other thing we do, which this gentleman here is nice enough to illustrate, is that dust is this black tarnished stuff. So in the optical, it hides stuff, but in the near infrared, you can start seeing through it, and sometimes it starts glowing on its own. So you can actually study it in the near infrared. And so astronomy has been moving to near and far infrared wavelengths for this very reason. The majority is first to get rid of the dust. For most astronomers, dust is an annoyance. So I'm telling them about the thing that is giving them headaches. But also for a new generation of astronomers, it's actually very interesting because it's doing all these interesting things, like planet formation. So if you're a galactic astronomer like myself, you look at galaxies like this. This is M51, the Whirlpool Galaxy. This is pretty much the first galaxy any telescope, as soon as you finished it, before the paint is dry, people look at this galaxy because it's so photogenic. And it's easily accessible from the northern hemisphere, so it's pretty much as soon as you have something new, there's an image of M51 coming out. So this is with the Hubble Space. This is not the Hubble Space Telescope. This is just a high resolution from the ground. But you can see all the purple and bluish new stars being formed. You see a galaxy full of old stars that are yellow over here, and you see all this dark band, and that's the dust that's kind of scattering and absorbing starlight. So if you look at it in the visible, dust shows up in these dark bands. But if you look at it in the infrared, it's actually emitting because it's not room temperature, but it is at a temperature where it's emitting heat. It's emitting this infrared emission. And so suddenly, the galaxy, instead of having these dark bands, those become bright, and you can see these holes here where the star formation has blown out old dust. So basically, it's like a spider web. It's very fluffy. So this, I had a student work on this galaxy, and she called it the bubbliest galaxy she's ever come across. Because it's blowing all these bubbles, all these new stars are blowing out these holes. Remember this, I'm having all kinds of trouble with this thing. Here, remember this? If this becomes any bigger, it blows a hole in the whole galaxy. So it looks like these bubbly galaxies.
So how far away is that?
That is about 5 billion parsecs away, so about 15 billion light years. It's pretty local as extragalactic astronomers go. It's local in that we can see the bits. So if we can go to the Hubble Space Telescope, we can see individual stars. So if we go to Hubble and can see individual stars, we think of it as pretty local. But as soon as we put it even further away and everything smooths out by distance, we kind of go, yeah, we're out.
It was closer with the infrared.
Yeah. So
the evolution of it.
This,
it was like 200 million light years away or something like that.
Well, the big influence is this thing over here. That is its companion. So every once in a while, we have to be reminded of the fact that it has a very close companion, and this has just gone for about a year and looped around it. And it's basically shocked everything and has given all the gas a nudge so that all the gas has basically collapsed, or a lot of the gas has collapsed into these filaments and started forming stars like mad. And that has blown all these holes in there. And the rest of it is pretty hot. So you get the hot dust glowing in the near infrared. You get all these young new stars being nice and bright and blue. And you see all these dark lanes at the air because everything has been kind of pushed together. So there's a lot going on in this galaxy. We've been using it as our okay, this is how all galaxy works. That's never a good idea. Like, every galaxy is special as soon as you get to know them, and that's true for this one as well. But what I wanted to point out is that everything dark shows up as a bright band here. This is one of my other, I started life as an astronomer on this a little bit over here. But this is called M101. It's another one of those galaxies where it has these big spirally arms full of blue stuff. But as soon as you look at the infrared, you see all these filamentary, this spider web of material. And that's flowing together to form stars. But that's the dust that we're looking for. So how do I get these infrared images? Because you can't get those from the ground. So this is wavelength, and this is how well we can see through our atmosphere. Our atmosphere is completely opaque, blocked gamma rays, X-rays, and ultraviolet. And thankfully so, because we'd be pretty fried if some of this stuff from the universe would actually get to us. So that's a good thing, except if you're an astronomer, because you're going to be like, I want that stuff, so I'm going to have to launch a satellite to get those. Here's the optical, so we build telescopes on big mountains we can see out into the universe. Infrared a little bit, and then here, most of the infrared spectrum is blocked. So you need a satellite out into space. So NASA goes, yay, great, we have a reason to launch a satellite. they're not very expensive. And from radio, you can actually do it from the ground again, and long wavelength radio is blocked again. But so radio from the ground, optical from the ground, and a little bit of infrared, but most of it you have to go to space. So recently, some of the pictures I showed you were from the Spitzer Space Telescope, the other ones were from the Herschel Space Telescope. I have worked as I have to kind of downplay that here since I'm not in Europe anymore, but I worked at the European Space Agency, so I am going to mention it. Also, it's ESA week, it's Herschel week, so we're kind of commemorating this mission, which was the European mission, this was the NASA mission. They were very complementary. so one looked at certain things and the Herschel looked at the other. But both, I worked on both of them. The nice thing about satellites is that once you get into space, they tend to work and not break because there's not that much to mess with them. So the Spitzer Space Telescope was meant to work for 3 years. It's on its 11th year right now. However, it's on an Earth trailing orbit. So the Earth is going around the Sun, and the Spitzer is kind of trailing behind. And at some point, we won't be able to talk to it because the Sun's in the way. It's not that the thing broke, it's just that we can't talk to it anymore. So it's getting harder to talk to this thing. And this just simply ran out of helium. It ran out of fuel. So both of them are kind of no more. So this is what I use the imaging for. But they've put out a lot of this data, like a lot of the infrared data.
Is this in a solar orbit rather than the one in
Yeah, so there's different ways that we like to put our satellites into space, right? So there's ones, the International Space Station is, for instance, 300 miles straight up. So if I put Kentucky on its edge, I can actually drive up there. It's not that high up. A lot of satellites are at that at those latitudes. There are the GPS satellites, for example, are pretty low Earth orbit. Then you get to higher Earth orbit or geosynchronous. That's great for if you want to have a weather satellite, always in the same spot, looking down on Earth. For infrared stuff, we want the Earth as far away from us as possible, because it's a hot ball of glowy stuff. So we don't want them anywhere near. So we put both of them far, far away. Herschel went to L2, so that's somewhere halfway between the Moon and the Earth, and that's a good place to park something. It can actually orbit a spot there. And Spitzer basically was launched so that it would follow the Earth, but in a ever slower orbit. So it was an Earth trailing orbit. So both of them as far away from the Earth as possible. This has a this shield here on this side is to keep the sunlight off. And also to put the solar panels on. So it's keeping the, with infrared it's basically that the biggest issue is not seeing your own telescope, not seeing the planet Earth or the Sun. And if we then, if you're not interested in those three things, then it gets hard because, you know, those things are the brightest glowy bulbs of warm stuff around. So, but yeah, they you need coolant, you need propellant for those things and they run out. And unlike Hubble, we can't send anybody up because this is very, very far away now. So what I do, now we're getting to where, which is my little corner of astronomy, is I study pairs of galaxies. So you have, I like this one, this is with Hubble. You see this front galaxy is kind of occulting or in front of a little spiral galaxy behind here. And this one nicely highlights the dust in this front galaxy. It acts as a light tail. And if I then go to Spitzer, I can say, okay, look, here, look, this stuff is glowing. Like, yep, nope, you see just as much on the other side, right? If you go here, you go like, well, there's a little bit. I mean, I see a little bit in front of this blue wall, but there's not as much as there is here, right? No. If I go to Spitzer, I can show, like, no, there's just as much on the other side. So how much of that dust is there in typically in a galaxy, and what does it do to the light of that galaxy is my question. So we study the missing light. It's a very fun and interesting way to do this. So instead of saying, like, okay, let's look at the emissions in dust, let's look at a place where I'm going like, okay, I know roughly what this galaxy should look like, and I'm missing all this light here. I'm studying the missing light using these pairs of galaxies. So overlapping galaxies, and we use this to study the missing light. Also, they're pretty. I mean, let's be honest here, right? We do this partly because we make pretty pictures. This is one of the reasons. So what we use the background galaxy as a light table for the dust in front. To say, okay, I know exactly how much light there should have been because I've modeled the background galaxy, and I know how much light there's missing here, and I know how much it's reddening. And here's my daughter using a light table in the Speed Art Museum. So I know the light tables haven't gone completely the way of the dinosaurs. So what I do is, here's the light from the background galaxy, and here's the light from the foreground galaxy. This is just foreground, this is just background, and here there's a mix of the two. So there's foreground with no dust in front of it, and there's the background with some dust in front of it. So I can model how much background contribution there is here, simply by assuming that I can flip this thing. And that's the only thing I'm assuming. I'm taking the contributions from here and here and saying, like, okay, that means I know how much light is missing there. That's it. I just assume symmetry. A spherical cow is what all my students are. Right? And so this is my galaxy. Most astronomers will have their object, like they take possession of it. It's very odd. But this is a very fun story. I had a friend who, there's a very large meeting, it's about 5,000 astronomers, it happens every year. You see your friend once, and you go, oh, let's meet up for lunch, and you don't see them for 5 days. It's that kind of meeting. And so I saw a friend, and she was like, oh, I have something, I'll tell you later. Like, no, don't tell me later, tell me now, because otherwise we'll never see each other again. And so she whipped this out, and she was like, I have this little galaxy, and I know you guys, you and Bill Keel at the University of Alabama, are interested in this kind of thing. Would you like to have the data? I just accidentally found this. And I'm like, yes, please, and thank you. So I wrote a paper in a very, very short amount of time. But not only that, we got to have a whole, you know, this is a Hubble Heritage image. And it's just a pure accident it was in her data, because she's not even looking at this thing. She was looking at this galaxy. And she was looking at this galaxy, and there was like a Hubble field here, and there was like just at the edge of her Hubble field was this pair of a galaxy. She wasn't interested in this thing at all. She was like, would you like it? And I'm like, yes, please. And so finding these things was a game of complete luck, because you have to have that cosmic accident. Like, when do you have two of them line up perfectly? You have to get very lucky, and they're very tricky to find with computers. It's okay to teach a computer what a star looks like. It's okay to teach a computer what a galaxy looks like. It's nearly impossible to tell a computer that they need a mashup like this. So I wasn't very good at this, and then back in 2007, we had 80 pairs or so, and I thought that was kind of it. I thought we had exhausted this particular venue of figuring out how these things work. But we thought, let's ask people. Let's ask a lot of people. Instead of just the astronomers, let's ask everybody. And literally, let's ask everybody. There was the Galaxy 2 project, and that went through the entire northern sky. There was a digital photo made called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. It was the first time that anybody took a digital picture of the entire sky. And we realized that we had 250,000 galaxies to look at, so there was no way to just hand this to a grad student and go, well, good luck with that. And so what they did was they got, like, all these people got together, but they made an app, effectively. They made a website and an app where you could classify yourself. There was a little thing where you could just, and frankly, this is the first time anybody's done this, just asked the general public for help. And it was a bit of a gamble because, you know, how often does that work? But it turns out, you know, people spend way more man hours on Angry Birds than they do on this. So I spend way more hours on Angry Birds than I do on this. But but people started classifying this and they got really good at it. And so we asked on the little, there was a talk with a bit of a chat room for the people who like doing this. So we didn't even ask, this wasn't even a classification question. This was just like, hey, if you see these, just give us a pin. And we thought, you know what, we'll go from 80 to like 120 or so. Great, that'll do. So these things start pouring in at a rate that's a little higher than we thought, a lot higher than we thought. There were 19,000 pairs and counting. So if you have a problem, ask your friends, ask strangers, or ask everybody, because I'm still analyzing all this stuff, and it's awesome. It's great to have friends, and it's great to have help. So we have many, many different kinds of pairs, many, many different kinds of lineups, so we can actually study in different kinds of galaxy kind of stuff. There we go. Great, now we have a sample. What do? First, you run over to the Hubble Space Telescope because you go, right, I have a really, really nice sample. You should totally look at that. And I am still very, very proud of this acronym because it's the Starlight Absorption Reddening Survey of Multiple Colton Galaxies, or star smog, which is exactly what we're looking for. It's the smog from stars. That's what we're going for. So we've been taking these monochromatic pictures of these overlapping pairs of all kinds. Here's like two right behind there. Let's see which one below there. And so they look every which way at every kind of configuration, because what we did was, well, we have so many of them. Hubble is the size of a bus. It literally is from the end of this room to that wall. It is a huge machine, and it takes a long time to slew a bus to its next version. So what you do is, in between looking at that thing and looking at that thing, if you've got something in the middle, and hey, look, I had something in the middle. That's called a snap program. So you look, you go from there to there, and you just take a little snap along the way, because it takes, you know, an orbit or so, or bubbles to slew. So these were short snapshots of many of these different pairs, and we're still analyzing them. I thought it makes some nice pictures. This was funny because I was looking for this pair, and I was hoping to find dust here. I didn't. But there's this tiny little dwarf galaxy that has all this dust all the way around it. So I'm calling these things bearded dwarfs, just because I just saw Lord of the Rings. we're seeing all these different pairs, and some of them really pop out, because we've got this spiral galaxy, this elliptical, pretty much perfect, and we see all this dust all the way out in really great detail. So the thing is that Herschel or Spitzer would have never been able to see that, because too cold and it's too fine to actually pick up with. This is a student at the University of Alabama, and she's just analyzing the dusty structures there. And we see all these little clouds floating out in the very edges of these galaxies. This is another one where you can kind of see all the structure happening. Like, you would never think that this galaxy would go all the way out there, but yes, there they are. There's these little pulls me out. I like this one because it's an edge-on galaxy that you see behind it. It'll be a complete headache to analyze, but it's pretty. So I'll take them. And these are these little two little ones that she analyzes. Yes, there's definitely a thing. So this is obviously our best one. This is the poster child. So the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going to be launched in October 2018. That is not a date that is not allowed to slip at all, ever. Or heads will roll, I'm told. So that is the next Hubble is going to look at that in the near infrared, and I also got time to look at the Hubble, so we'll have multicolor images on the Hubble particular
camera. How do the galaxies spin counterclockwise on hurricanes?
So do they spin clockwise or counterclockwise? Well, this one looks like it's kind of counterclockwise. You just accidentally hit on a very fundamental question. Does everything spin one way or not? They don't, to the best of my knowledge. This is one of the questions that we try to answer with the Galaxy Zoo project. They ask, which way do the spiral arms go? Do they go counterclockwise or clockwise? And are there just as many clockwise as counterclockwise galaxies in the universe? And the answer seems to be yes, there is an equal number of both. There was the fundamental question is like, is there a preferred direction? Any astronomer would get very nervous if there's like one direction that points that way. Like that place is special in the universe. So far that just means your methods are wrong. so far we've noticed that there's just as many spinning one way as do the other. Does that answer your question?
Say they're equal?
They're about equal, yeah. If I've shown too many going this way, it's just pure luck. So when we study dust in overlapping galaxies, we observe directly how the dust in the foreground galaxy is affecting the light because it's dimming the background one. It's dimming and reddening it. We can observe how far it goes. We can see the little detailed structure in there, even better than we can emission. We can learn everything from how many stars there are, from how many stars are formed, the distances about galaxies, and the light we observe. So it's really important to see how much dust is messing that up. So for every time you want to do one better in astronomy, one better accuracy in astronomy, you have to kind of take it, actually you have to come up with a better way to correct your dust. And the example I was going to give was distances. So I like this picture because it shows the two ways you can measure a distance. You can either know it's this big, so I know that cow is very far away because it's big. Or I know that candle is that far away because it's very dim. So you can have a standard candle or you can have a standard yardstick. So I know how big things are. Turns out we don't have a good standard yardstick. Galaxies are all kinds of sizes. But we do have standard candles, and they're called supernova. So there's one going off in a nearby galaxy, and you notice that it's almost as bright as the rest of the galaxy. For a few days, the supernova burns just as brightly as the rest of the host galaxy. So you can see these things halfway through the universe, literally. You can see them halfway through the universe. So they're a great way, and they're always the same brightness. That's the other part. They peak at the same brightness and then they fall off and then you never see them again, but they peak at the same brightness, meaning that we can know how far they are. And so that has become our distance measure, our yardstick, our standard candle in order to find distances in the universe. I was going to show four graphs today, so you'll have to bear with me. This is the second one, so we're good. These are the distances from these supernova, and this is how fast it's moving away. So how fast something is moving away and its distance are related by something called the Hubble law. And so here's the residual, or basically if I subtract my best cosmology off from it, you see these points, and you see this black line. This black line is our best evidence that there's something else that's accelerating the universe. It's pushing out the galaxies a little further, faster than they should be going. And you see all this scatter here, and you think, oh, these people haven't done their measurements correctly enough. No, they've done their measurements just fine. they simply haven't corrected for the dust in each galaxy. They just corrected for the galaxy, like for a model galaxy. And so there's quite a bit of scatter. There's quite a bit because the host galaxies for the supernova have different amounts of dust in them. So that's where I'm going to come in and going to go give them individual tailor. This is how much you should correct for each kind of galaxy. So that's one of the goals for my project, StarSmog, is to improve the measurements for the supernova so we learn more about this mysterious dark energy, because this bump is all we have right now. So what I would like to do is, if you have a, this is the second, this is the third graph, so you're nearly out of graphs, so we're fine, right? So I think that if you have a massive galaxy, you have more dust in it. If you have a smaller galaxy, but you're in the middle of it, you have about this much. If you go outside, there's less of a chance of extinction. So basically, I want to give other astronomers the weather prediction. This is your chance of hitting this much dust. And so if you then get a supernova, if you predict it with the dashed line, yeah, you're right on the mark, money. But if you underpredict it because you're in a big galaxy, you might plunk it down too low or too high, depending on how much dust you're in the foreground.
So you're like Mythbusters blowing up the same thing over and over again, but changing it a little bit, getting in that
Well, what I'm hoping to give is the prescription is give them the, as soon as they see the supernova go off and they go like, oh, it's in a big galaxy with, you know, big spiral arms, they'll go like, okay, this is your chance of this much stuff. So they can model their light curve accordingly. And the field, these are real data points. The stuff is all over the place. That's still because they can't correct for dust accurately enough. And this is fine. They just do the first bit. That's fine. We needed to be about 10% accuracy, but now we want 1% accuracy, and so that's the step of 10 better with everything. So that's what I'm trying to come in. I'm trying to give them the weather. That's really what I'm trying to do. So that was the graphs. So we're good. But this is the summary slide on everything we know about dark energy. It's there. It seems to be working. That's it. We don't know what's causing it. We don't exactly know what it's going to be. We don't know why it's even there. Einstein, back in the day, put this constant in there to kind of fudge something. So he always felt it was a fudge factor, and he called it his biggest mistake. And now we have this fudge factor back, and we're kind of going, why is that there? There's something pushing out, and so we're trying to figure out what that is and why it's doing that and why we're seeing this. So we'd like some more slides on this in astronomy. So that's why we're doing the bigger supernova project, and I'm trying to do the dust. Oh, sorry, last slide. Here we go. Galaxy light and colors. So this is something I did with a couple people. So here's the wavelength, and this is how bright a galaxy is. So I measured it as a function of wavelength. Getting all these points, and here. There was the first person who modeled this, and was like, oh, our model seems to be working just fine. And then I added a couple more points with the Herschel Space Telescope, the one that I introduced, and you get a picture like this. And you go, okay, well, that almost works. Let's try to model it ourselves. And so we made a model that looked like this. So this is the dust in the galaxy, and kind of smooth, because that's where you start with. that kind of works, but it doesn't here, and it doesn't here, and that turns out to be important, because as soon as I say, well, I didn't see any clumpiness, so I'll put the dust in clumps, and that'll look better. As soon as I do that, I get this model, and I don't predict these fluxes, these amounts of light correctly. So how to model all the way, this is from the ultraviolet, the optical, near infrared, all the way to the far infrared, if you want to model that, and you want to add clumps, because you're seeing clumps, you get it wrong unless you put 10 times dust in already. So we keep adding dust to this thing, and we have to heat them a little bit, and then it kind of works. But we needed 10 times the dust than the original authors. So it's really tricky to figure out how much dust there is in a typical galaxy and how much you need for that you need. So what you need is you need to know how clumpy these things are, because then you compare your model, for instance, to the original data that you took. and you go, well, okay, this is starting to look like each other, like these things. If that smooth model didn't work at all, but we need to know how these clumps are distributed. So that's again why we do these overlapping galaxies, because then we see the final structure. We see, okay, there's this many big clumps, this many small clumps. So we're looking for clumps. This is super exciting for Far Infrared Astronomy, by the way, because for the longest time it looked like just one blob, and it was blobology the entire time. And so having stuff that acts with actual structure is good. So that's how we're trying to explain how to actually understand what happens to light as it's leaving the stars and going through the medium in between the stars and before it hits our eyes and our detectors. What happens to it? Because the light disappears here at the ultraviolet and reappears here at the far infrared, and that's what stuff is doing. So those are my two main reasons. I want to figure out what light looks like from galaxies and why, and I want to make sure that I've got the right distances to. So those are my two motivations to study these overlapping galaxies. And please have some questions for me. Thank you. No, this is an excellent question. So we know that there is very pristine gas between galaxies. We've seen some of it. It's mostly theory. The further away you go from stars, the colder it gets. So the less it lights up. So it's harder to see. As soon as you get from anything that's warm, it gets harder and harder to see. We have seen some of this in absorption towards quasars. So we know there's gas, and we know there's even some metals in there. So we think that supernova, the very earliest galaxies, blew this stuff out far and wide. And yeah, there is definitely some dust in there. It's hard to tell. So we squint pretty hardly, but hardly is not a word. Sorry, we squint pretty hard, but it's there might be some. There's definitely some stuff there, but how much is a bit of a discussion. So. And with a bit of discussion, I mean like whole conference is worth of discussion, right? So there's like 500 people there having a heated debate.
I did like Detroit. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I've only been to the airport.
So how far out does, you know, dust associated with the galaxy go out from the star?
So, again, we had a whole conference about that. How the outskirts of galaxies, so the very outer parts of galaxies, so grayscale images. Here, for example. So what these outer parts look like. Yeah, so you can come and see bits in there, but again, you know, as far as if you get further away from the bulk of the stars, it gets colder and colder and colder. And if I turn the heat all the way down to 10 Kelvin, nothing is going to glow. I can hide whatever I want out there. So we had a big discussion about this, because you kind of see stars, and if you put the Hubble, you know, further and further, I have a program to look the furthest out. And every time we do this, and we look long enough, we go like, nope, still stars, keep moving. Nope, still stars, keep moving. Still stars. So it peters out very, very, very slowly. So stars are still there. We see gas still there. And for the longest time, people thought it was just gas. It was just a gas from the outer intergalactic medium kind of accreting onto this galaxy, becoming new fuel for stars, for the galaxy itself. But it turns out there's still stars out there. There's still dust out there. It gets thinner and thinner, but it never quite peters out. It looks like an island because it looks like it has a beach, but like a beach, it keeps going just under where you can see it. It's just, so.
Yeah, the webby, you know, structure there kind of reminds me of a large scale.
It does. It's very much like nature mimicking itself.
Yep.
If you go down to individual regions, so it looks spindly and connected and like this web, like almost like you've got coffee or something like that. So you've got something sugary and sticky, you know, you just pull it out together and you've got all these little filaments. If you zoom into any kind of region here and you look at it, it's self-similar all the way down. Like it keeps being these filaments in this. This seems to be the way the universe organizes itself. With these little holes and then these filaments around it. So the holes here are partly blown by supernova or a big star is blowing up. And some of them are simply, there never was any stuff, there's something close around it. So yeah, the answer is tricky, because as soon as I come up with pictures like, my remote is not working. So for instance, something like this. This is twice as big in dust than it is in the optical. I show this, but people who study small galaxies kind of would have said like, oh yeah, the galaxy ends here. Nope, twice as big than that. And this is a dwarf galaxy, right? Dwarf galaxies are not supposed to have tons of stuff in it. Like, definitely not a lot of dust. Sorry. It looks very dusty. This is my crusty beardy dwarf, right? This is one of my beardy dwarfs, and there it is. So you are still going to have this stuff far, much further out than you think it was, because we just thought in terms of, you know, oh, they're here, they're about halfway through, that's where the dust planes are, and that's it. But no, it keeps going. There's still a little bit left, and especially this one. I just like it. It's very, very pretty, and it's a perfect example of astronomy being a windshield science. I love this description where if you drive along, whatever you pick up, that you can do your bug science with that, because whatever you pick up along the road, the stars in here are not stars in our own Milky Way. There are the stars in the galaxy in this galaxy. So we're trying to find the edge of this galaxy. Look there, you can see that there's still the edge, like, but it's petering out. So we're still looking at the stars here. But you also got this one star from our own Milky Way. There's another dwarf star from our own Milky Way. Here's this intermediate distance, like, well, it's further away than this one. And then there's even further galaxies you can see. Like, if you look there in one direction, you get whatever is in there, all kind of smushed together. So this is why I like the term windshield science, because everything is...
So if you're having redshift from dust, if you're correcting distances, the correction is all to, you know, if there's extra redshift,
it's
closer, right?
That's true. Not quite, because if I... All right. This is the one drawback for this thing, because I have to go all the way back here. Here's my model. The model that I'm using, if the model is correct for the galaxy that I have, I'm right in the money. But if I've got a model that's under-predicting how much dust there is, because I've been using a ho-hum galaxy, not a big one, for example, then I'm overcorrecting. So you can be correcting on either side. This is totally something. It's probably more of these than it is of these, but I don't know that yet. What I'm saying to the supernova people is, use all the information you've got. You see these things go off next to a galaxy. Tell me what that galaxy is. How big is it? How bright is it? Where exactly, with reference to the galaxy, did it go off? And then I got all the information, so we can combine that into a better measurement. Because we want to get down to 1%, which is tricky.
So when we started, you called Earth a big chunk of dust.
Yeah, pretty much.
So at what point are you interested in the dust organizing?
So I said the catalyst, for example. So it helps with chemistry. It also helps radiating heat away. So if you want to compress a big ball of gas into a planet and stars, for example, it helps radiating the heat away so it can cool down more, so it can compress more and cool down more. So it helps actually build form stars and planets. It helps so the very first grains kind of click together with coal, so they're kind of these icy, gritty things, and so kind of they stick together until they become a snowball. And then there's basically an asteroid. And that asteroid can clump together with bigger asteroids. And so eventually, we don't quite know how this works yet, by the way. We can get to something about a yard that large, and then basically you've got a poorly made snowman, and if you want to smush that together with another poorly made snowman, you basically end up with, you know, a bunch of balls of snowballs, and that doesn't seem to stick very well. So how do you get from about 3-4 feet large things to planet-sized things is tricky, but we think that basically they hoover up all the dust around them, and that's how they grow into.
So should we be concerned about another planet being
at the Mars? Oh, no. No, the nice thing about the solar system, it's old. So whatever orbit you were on, whatever orbit it is on, it's been on there that for 5 billion years.
So
it's ticking along there. It's fine. I know there's this story going around which is like, oh, Planet Nine's going to crash into us. Like, okay, we do miss the occasional asteroid, but a whole planet would be harder to miss. We definitely be on that. Planet Nine is at the moment extremely contentious because it would have to be on an orbit much further than Pluto, and starting to look like it's more of an effect from the models that the people said that there might be a Planet Nine than there actually is a Planet Nine. But it's a fun thing to hunt if you have a telescope, right? It's so there is a small telescope called WISE, which is orbiting Earth, and it's doing this near-infrared survey, and it does this over and over again, so it's looking for these little asteroids and things, little things that move between, you know, the first time it took an image and the second time it took an image. And so it's looking for all these little things that move, and people have been looking for Planet Nine in there, and if they haven't found anything yet, okay. They found all kinds of, they found our nearest neighbor, neighboring stars, 2.8 light years away. It's an M dwarf. M dwarfs are these almost failed stars, and yeah, it's very close by. It's also extremely faint, so they wouldn't have picked it up otherwise. Alpha Centauri, which is whenever you read a book, was the nearest star to us, right? Everybody says Alpha Centauri, the nearest star is 4.25 light years away. No, there's a star that's closer by. There's two stars that are closer by. They were found that way. So, looking for a bit that moves ever so slightly is useful. You can find little planets, you can find little stars. It's even money whether or not there's a Planet Nine. I wouldn't bet a beer on it at the moment. So, that should tell you how much money I'm willing to gamble on that. So, any other questions? Anybody else? I have plenty of time, I have a beer, I'm good.
You showed you have about a couple of objects, right?
Yes.
Most of them from Sloan.
They're mostly from Sloan, but they're coming in from other surveys as well.
So the size of the 80 you have from the local volume, this is how most of them look like.
This
so
is what
you are running into the problem that resolution becomes an issue, right?
No, I just go to Hubble.
This is what you have to do. You have to go and observe each of those with Hubble to get your clumpiness, get the model right.
No, the biggest problem is figuring out how far each of them are. So there's Sloan has done a redshift typically on one of them because they do this with little fibers. So they plug a little fiber in a plate and they put another fiber in the next one, and that's how they observe the spectrum for each of these galaxies. But you can't put the fibers this close together. So I typically get a redshift for one of them, and then I have to go guess if the other one is in front or in the back. So that's kind of the issue. The nice thing is with nearly 2,000 of them, I can throw away whatever I want because I still have 100 left. I can look at all kinds of weird configurations. I'll have 100 of them. So instead of having trying to find some general rule from one thing, I can look at a specific question, which is very nice. I can give a student like, okay, here's this question answered with these 100, go. And so that helps a lot.
But for the clumpiness of the stuff,
that's where
you need high resolution imaging.
That's where I need high resolution imaging, but I have 50 of these.
So you are definitely waiting actually for
WFIRST? No, WFIRST is the next one.
Then you have to wait even longer.
Yes. The James Webb Space Telescope is officially Hubble's follow-up. It looks at about the same area of sky. So it takes a little postage stamp of the sky. Somebody did, for fun, how long would it take us to take a picture of the entire sky with Hubble? And it turns out it was 1,000,000 years, so NASA didn't fund it. This is a trusty old machine. It's been going on for 25 years, so that is longer than most people have run a car. And it's in space, which is not exactly a forgiving environment. So the next time it's running on a 486, if any of you remember what that kind of computer that is.
Yeah.
And so it's running on this ancient hardware that has just been trucking along for a very long time. Nobody's going to come up there. The last thing that will happen is there's going to be a small rocket going up. It'll hook up through the back of it, and it'll splash the whole thing down in the Atlantic because the mirror is it's about a ton worth of glass and metal back here. So that's actually a pretty good heat shield. So yes, if you drop this thing down on Earth unguided, it would hit something because it would burn up completely. So the initial plan for Hubble was to be taken back with a space shuttle, except that nobody did the math. The space shuttle landing gear would not take the heat or the weight or any. This would have been a suicide mission for any astronaut. So it is not going back to any kind of museum. It is going to burn up. But for that, we need a controlled burn. So it turns out there is a company that says, yes, we know how to do this. If you ask for details, they'll say, yes, we know how to do this. because Hubble's specs are suspiciously close to what we guess are about 24 similar satellites operated by the NSA. So, they have deorbited one of these things safely. So that's what will happen to Hubble when and if it breaks. The fact that we're well over 25 years now, and the fact that the last servicing mission was over 8 years ago, means that this is probably happening, and it will be a very sad day for astronomy because we love our little telescope. It's getting on a bit.
We will be the poorer for it.
But you have to be fair compared to other satellites who are 5 to 10 years. That thing has been repaired 3 times.
So
it's actually not working with ancient technology. The actual astronomical technology in there is less than 10 years old.
Yeah. So there's a couple of bits in there that are a lot newer. That's true. But for instance, these panels were replaced last time. This is the guidance back to Earth. So that's the high gain antenna. They're only using one of them at the time. The other one is probably broken at this point, but we haven't tested it because you have to switch the guidance all the way over, and then if it doesn't work, you lost contact with Hubble. So it's very likely that's one of those single points of failure. If it fails and we don't get a reaction from it, it will just be in orbit for a while and then hook up a little rocket. Any other questions? Like, I'm happy to talk, whatever.
How often are you going to death?
Pardon?